We have a great pleasure from another visitor, and this time we can thank UM. Last week we had Howie Bluestein, and he got to visit over at UM. This time we have John Molinari visiting over at UM, who's with us today. I have known John since we were both graduate students. John was at FSU, I was at MIT. We started about the Gate era. We're of that vintage. So we were both grad students. John worked with Trish, and I was with Fred Sanders. My best recollection of John, though, is our time together in PDT 5. We spent 2 days in Tallahassee, immersed together, working. My recollection is Anthony's on the bay, sitting there with placemat that we were drawing pictures on. Mike Montgomery was browbeating John, as well as most of us. But it was an excellent 2 or 3 days. We had a great team, put together a really nice report, which I think is still very relevant. We had a session at the AMS conference this year in January where we talked about how far we moved along the path of PDT-5. And the thing that struck me and I wanted to bring out was one of the things we did in PDT-5 was we picked the impacts of the tropical cyclone to focus everything, and then we telescoped all the research back to how do we use that research to address the impacts, which is very relevant today as we move forward in the, what they call Weather Ready Nation that NOAA's pushing forward. But since that time and in many other times, I have interacted with John a lot. He's collaborated with us on many papers, Peter Dodge and I, at least one that I know of, on the Gabrielle event. And then he's come and talked to us a lot about the impacts of shear on the vortices. I think the last talk you gave here was actually, other than when you were here for GRIP and happened to drop in, I think the last talk you gave was on helicity.
Right.
And the impacts of helicity and how the vortex can, how the vortex structure focuses the helicity in certain areas. And today he's going to talk to us about CAPE, which is another hot topic that's coming from the severe storm side and coming in. And I hope John fills us in on how we have to worry about CAPE. So without further ado, John Molinari. And thank you for coming to help today, Shadi.
Well, thank you, Frank. I've been actually coming here pretty regularly since 1981, and so it's really nice to come back. This is the longest since then that I haven't. I think it's been 3 years, so I hope it's not 3 years in the future. I don't know. I think there were just too many things going on in Albany for a while, but anyway, it's great to be back, and I've always really enjoyed my visits here. Very stimulating. So as Frank said, I am talking about CAPE today. Now to advance, So today I'm talking about CAPE in tropical cyclones, and I just sent a notice that you might have seen a day or two ago to the tropical storms list with a paper we just had accepted on this. So those are the authors of that paper. What I'll do is talk a little bit about the data, though this is data that a lot of you are familiar with, so I won't have to spend too much time on that. Talk about how we calculate the CAPE. And then the focus of the study was the upshear, downshear differences in CAPE and tropical cyclones, and also spend a little time on the vertical distribution of buoyancy. Now, I have to apologize in advance to talk about the calculation of CAPE. There's going to be a lot of kind of text slides before we get to the results. But at any rate, we're using the G4 soundings. And so those are, I just used the ones that Sim Averson processed, so there's 32 storms.
I provided them.
Okay, well.
I think everybody here processed.
Provided by Sim Averson, those are the ones that were provided by Sim Averson. And of course, as you know, most of those are in hurricanes a fraction, about a quarter in tropical storms, not too many in depressions. And anything that was listed as questionable by Edison, we left out. But we did have one other error we found, and it was very rare. It was either 5 or 6 sons that there was a perfect humidity field all the way down, and then right above the surface, it was like 10% or something. And somehow, I don't know how that slipped through, but we just marked those as missing, of course. That's just a handful of sons. And then the other thing we did is this correction for these near dry adiabatic saturated layers. That was about 3% of the sons. And an example of that, let me get the mouse here. This is an example from Hurricane Erin of the nature of this correction. And this comes from a work that Gary Barnes and James Franklin have done. This is their correction, or also Paul Bogner, who was actually an Albany undergraduate. So we're using their method to correct it. And basically what happens in this case is that this just starts at 850 hectopascals down to the surface, the bottom of the sond in Erin. And you can see there's a saturated layer. And of course, in a tropical cyclone, there's a lot of liquid water, a high water content in these. And when the sond, we think at least, when the sond falls out from the cloud base, because it's been through such a wet layer that the moisture sensors has liquid water on it, and it takes a while for that to evaporate before it indicates that it's unsaturated. And so what you get is a layer in which this is the well-mixed layer and boundary layer. And I'm sorry, I didn't mention the blue is temperature. And the red is the dew point that the sond is reporting. And then the green is going to be the corrected dew point. And so what you see is that there's basically a well-mixed layer in potential temperature, but it's not well-mixed in specific humidity. And we think that's physically unrealistic, and we think there's a meaningful instrument weakness that produces that. To my knowledge, I just can't imagine a process in which you could get a saturated dry adiabatic layer. I can't think of any physical process that would produce that. So basically what's done in this correction is you simply say that where it's well mixed in temperature, or potential temperature, we'll make it well mixed in moisture. So that now this is basically the corrected thing. And although it's very subtle, and it's right at the bottom of the sond, this makes a 400 joules per kilogram reduction in cake. Yes?
For this correction, did you do this using Edison, or did you do this correction manually?
It's not manual, no. Well, I have to now go back. I mean, it is programmed in, but basically we're finding a mixed layer, and then I don't remember the details of the Bogner correction, but basically we're bringing a specific humidity value down well mixed from one level above that mixed layer. I remember the exact details, but it is done in an automated way.
But it's not in it's evaporated. It's an
right.
additional
correction. Right, right. And as I said, it's about 3% of the sons in this case. The son data we interpolate to 100-meter levels, and if there are gaps of less than 400 meters in the sounding, we interpolate temperature and dew point, unless it's near the bottom, of course. But otherwise, we don't use the son. And we only consider sons within 1,000 kilometers of the center, and release point had to be above 400 hectopascals. And that left us with about 2,450 sons for analysis. Above the sond release level, we appended the lapse rate, which is interpolated from the European Center analysis. And the idea of interpolating the lapse rate rather than the temperature is you don't get a temperature discontinuity at the top.
So pretty much you're only using G4
now? Yes, only G4, yeah. Now, the thing about the appending the European Center, of course, that can really impact the tape. And in particular, in Bogner's early study, they used these omega sons released at an average pressure of about 450 hectopascals. And when you compute pseudo-adiabatic tape with those sons, two-thirds of the tape is above the release level. And so for that layer, you had to, they appended a mean tropical cyclone sounding. But obviously, the cape is then impacted a lot by this appended sounding. And the beauty of the G4 sons is with that release level, most of that's near 180 hectopascals, that most of the tropopause is directly measured by the sond, and that's a big benefit for calculating tape. Now, this, I'm not telling you where the hurricane is in this, I figure you can tell that, but this is, does anyone remember this picture or know what storm it is? I had this on my disk, but I have no idea what storm it is. I know.
Yeah,
right. I know sometimes I'm amazed at this crowd that can say, oh, yeah, I remember that was Tuesday morning and we flew in on it. But anyway.
Jack Bevin is the only one who remembers.
Well, Jack's here, and even Jack doesn't remember. So what I've done here is this is my estimate of the vertical shear direction in this. And the point of showing this is that, you know, we're talking about tape in tropical cyclones, so then we're talking about convection, basically. And what you see, of course, is that there are elevated higher clouds in the core. And if you look closely, the biggest overshooting tops, or at least the highest tops, are in this quadrant. And so my guess would be, based on the cloud distribution, that the shear is actually coming from the other side. So there's less convection, lower tops on the side of the eye wall. And then in the outer bands, the convection starts kind of down shear right and swings around to down shear and down shear left. So that's my guess of the shear direction. And of course, there's a region, and this showed clearly in our lightning data, there's a region outside the eye wall and inside the outer bands that really has a minimum in lightning frequency. And also, the percentage of positive flashes in this region, flashes that bring down positive charge to ground, is much higher. And that, this region seems to behave like the anvil region of a thunderstorm. So basically, perhaps there's, you know, the high cloud coming out from the core. And then the outer rain bands typically range from about, I think Andrew before Florida was relatively small, and then it was maybe like 150 kilometers the outer rain band started, were very highly electrified. But typically it might be more like 200 and extend out to 380 or 400 kilometers. You have much larger lightning, not just lightning frequency, but lightning density in these outer bands. This is this one you'll recognize, and of course this is Katrina right before landfall in New Orleans, and I suspect that, well, now I'll ask you again, whether this might be a little after the maximum intensity, because there doesn't seem to be a lot of overshooting tops, so it's on its way to Category 3 probably at this point. And
just starting downhill.
Yes, yes. And so there's no overshooting tops in the core, which is not surprising. I mean, we do see with the lightning data that if the storm's not intensifying, the cloud-to-ground lightning, at least, rather than intercloud, is very rare in the core. But you still see the outer bands active. The reason I put this up, though, is that in the Bogner's calculations, the maximum pseudo-adiabatic tape was at 500-kilometer radius. Now, he just calculated out to 500, but we're going to see that, too. 5 to 600-kilometer radius is the maximum pseudo-adiabatic tape. So if I go out that distance from Katrina, that's about this region, this region and this region, 500 kilometers. And what that it's really striking about those regions is the lack of convection. And then in the Bogner study, the smallest cape is in the core. And, well, the question is, what exactly is cape telling us then? If the cape is large out here where it's not convecting and the cape is small where it is convecting? And the answer can be simply that, well, you know, the cape builds up where it's not convecting because you get the fluxes into the from the ocean, and but perhaps it's suppressed because of subsidence a lot. And the cape is being consumed in the core, so that's why. But then it's a little puzzling then, because what we're saying is that cape tells us, high cape tells us where it's not convecting and low cape where it is. And what I'm going to argue in this talk is actually that's an artifact of pseudo-adiabatic. So, of course, as you know, but I'll mention this, that with the pseudo-adiabatic, the condensate falls immediately, and, of course, there's no mixing in that. That's by far the most common calculation, of course, because it's pretty easy to do. The reversible tape is there's still no mixing, but you're keeping all the condensate with the parcel. And so, naturally, the buoyancy is reduced. So, the Jew and Emmanuel argued that, basically, with reversible tape, if you start a cloud base, the tropics are near moist neutral, although there's been a lot of arguments against that. But that was the argument that they argued you should use reversible cape rather than pseudo-adiabatic. Now, Romps and Kwong, this is how I get started in this. David Romps, who was working with Jimin Kwong at Harvard at that point, calculated this detailed cloud model and calculated parcel properties and deep convection in the tropics. And he included, everything, condensate loading, entrainment, heating by fusion. And I thought, wow, that would be cool. There are all these signs. It would be cool to calculate cape and hurricanes using this model, and that's how we got started. And, of course, if you can calculate a detailed parcel evolution with the temperature, then the sounding becomes the environment, and the parcel becomes, and you can calculate cape naturally from that, and spin. Now, we're going to include fusion heating and entrainment and condensate loading. How important is fusion heating? Well, Ed Zipser and also Romson Kwong and recently Fierro et al. Have argued that, in fact, in the tropics, updrafts can't reach the tropopause unless you add fusion heating, and in tropical cyclones as well. And Joanne Simpson is actually a co-author in this paper, and she did come around to this view that basically there isn't this undiluted ascent in these hot towers, that you have to get this boost from fusion heating in the upper troposphere to get these parcels all the way to the tropopause. Now, another thing about fusion heating, Williams and Renault made an interesting argument that this is at the time that Kerry Emanuel was saying you've got to use reversible and not super-rated batteries. And they said, well, if you have to include the effect of water loading, then you should be including fusion as well. And when they put fusion heating in, it almost went right back to the pseudo-adiabatic value. So their argument at the time is all this saying you've got to use reversible, you don't have to. I mean, if you add fusion to the reversible, you get right back to the same point.
Well, John, also there's an assumption in Alex's presentation that it's creek convection, not force.
Yes.
Whereas in NIWAL, there's a whole other thing going on.
Now, that's a good point. That's a good point. And I'll touch on that a little bit, as we'll see. But so in this study, the way we put fusion in, and one of the difficult things about all these calculations is, so when does the water freeze? And, of course, well, it varies. But what we're going to assume is that the water transitions linearly to ice between the freezing level and 240K. We did do some other calculations where it freezes all at once. And fusion, of course, becomes more important because you're adding heat all at once. But the general conclusions don't really change that much. Now, entrainment is the other thing we added. Romson Kwong, in this very detailed, they have this very clever way of determining in a cloud model whether a parcel is mixing with its environment and stuff. And they found that the fraction of undiluted parcels fell below 1% above 4 kilometers in their cloud model. And that's certainly obviously arguing that entrainment is occurring a lot. Holloway and Nealon, in order to produce the observed correlation between precipitable water and precipitation in the tropics, they had to include entrainment in their parcel. Basically, the physical process, which I think makes sense to everyone, is where the air is very dry, you get less precipitation because you have entrainment of dry air. Mark DeMaria, I actually appreciate this paper more the more I read it, I'm not surprised that the LGEM does very well, that model, because he looked at buoyancy in the tropical cyclone environment as one of the important variables in his logistic regression model, but he had to include entrainment to produce realistic results in that. And then Wei et al. In 98 talked about the fact that entrainment has 4 times the influence of condensate loading. So how can you then put one in without the other? But the big question is how do you parameterize it? There have been some studies that came out recently, like for shallow clouds. The entrainment comes in through the top of the cloud. And there's a very cool paper that I don't remember who the authors were even recently, but you get big holes in these. If you do extremely high-resolution simulations of stratocumulus, you get big holes in them, and that's where all of the entrainment is on the top, and that's where all the entrainment is occurring. Well, the way we're going to entrain is what's often done. We're going to use a constant rate of dilution with height, so by implication, the air is coming in from the side. And we don't really know exactly how entrainment works in updrafts. In Romson Kwong's paper, what's interesting is that the average parcel had an entrainment rate of 100% per kilometer. So it was entraining as much air as it started with at the bottom of the layer over a single kilometer. But using his phrase, the lucky few updrafts that reach the tropopause have an effective entrainment on the order of 5%. So if you're studying deep convection, then maybe what you should be doing is putting in something more this order. So we used 5, 10, and 20% per kilometer we tried for the entrainment. It's an oversimplified view, but the entrainment is so important, we'll see that you can't leave it out, even though admittedly it's a relatively crude way to put it in. CAPE, as usual, we calculate a sum of positive buoyancy, but anybody who knows about operations, like particularly in the U.S. operations, where do you start the parcel? That's a big question. And like in operations, often they mix the lowest 500 meters before they calculate the CAPE. Well, again, back to Romson Kwong, they found that in their simulations that 2/3 of subcloud air that convected into the free troposphere actually came from below 100 meters. So they argued that to calculate CAPE, it's best to just start at the 100, just start lifting your parcel from 100 meters. And that's what we'll be doing. this is kind of a detail. Maybe I won't go into this a lot, but, well, I'll mention it since it's here. We want to compare CAPE and SIN for these various calculations. But the problem with SIN is that can you define SIN if you don't have any CAPE? I mean, what meaning does it have? But the problem is that, like, with fusion, you might have CAPE, and without fusion, no CAPE. So if you only compute SIN when you have CAPE, you have an uneven sample. You really can't compare SIN. So what we did instead is we just took the SIN up to a particular level, up to 1.5 kilometers. So you lift the parcel. And the way we're calculating SIN, it's not quite the sum of the negative areas, which is often what's done. Because if you get negative and then positive and then negative again, in that positive region, it accelerates. And so what we do with the SIN is we calculate the minimum buoyancy required or the minimum energy required to reach the 1.5 kilometer level. And so these values do tend to, on average, be a little smaller than you usually see. Then, because once you add entrainment, you can't use the terms reversible and pseudo-adiabatic. So we'll say all fall is like the pseudo-adiabatic case, but all fall with entrainment or no fall. That's what we mean by that. Either all the condensate falls out or it's all kept with the parcel. All right, now finally we get to figures then. This is with respect to shear, the distribution of those 2,500 SONs. And it's nice. This is how it goes. The shaded region is the 100-kilometer, inner 100 kilometers. And so otherwise, these are 200-kilometer ranges. And you can see we get a pretty nice distribution of SONs with respect to shear from these 2,500 SONs. This is the number of SONs in each radial bin. And of course, this is where the weakness of the G4 comes in, because this is how many there are in the 0 to 100 kilometers. We can't look at the core with these calculations. And so that's too bad, but you know, that's the limitation we have. And the frequency of SONs peaks, it looks like, between about 300 and 700 kilometer radius.
And these are not only hurricanes, they're all?
Yeah, depression to hurricanes.
Depression to hurricanes.
Yeah, and only within 1,000 kilometers.
Yeah, okay. And there are a few sounds in the eye and eye wall of category 4 video.
Yes. Well, it just turns out, like, since we're comparing upshear and downshear, when we do the statistical significance, there are so few SONs in the inner 100 that basically it's...
But if you want to do a case study...
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Uh-huh.
Right, right. And those are much closer in, right. Now we're finally getting to results. This is the radial distribution of CAPE, the mean. And the blue line here is just the pseudo-adiabatic CAPE. And this looks pretty similar to the Bogner curve. And it's smallest in the core. And in the core now here is only 100 to 200, unfortunately. It's as far in as we can go. And it maximizes about 500 to 600. Here's the reversible CAPE. It's basically half as large. And it's quite a difference, but it's just because tropical cyclones have a lot of condensate holding them back. So the difference is quite large. But just like Williams and Reynolds said, when we add fusion back, it goes almost right back to pseudo-adiabatic. That's the purple line. So that, interestingly, there's all these arguments about, well, you've got to use reversible. Well, you know, it does seem like the pseudo-adiabatic comes back when you add fusion. But, of course, the most drama in this figure is, what the heck are these lines? This is what happens when we put in entrainment. And, wow, I mean, instead of having 1,800, there's like a 90% decrease in CAPE when you add entrainment. And this, the green line is with fusion and the blue without. Notice the difference between the red and the purple line, which is the effect of fusion, is much greater than the difference between the cyan and the green. The reason is that in an entraining parcel, there's just a lot less condensate in there because it's been evaporated by the entraining process. So there's much less available to freeze. And that's why there's a smaller difference. So I put this in to make sure I say everything. So I've said those two. So that in all of the CAPE values without entrainment, you get a maximum near 600 to 700 kilometers. But with entrainment, there's a much flatter profile of CAPE with radius. And as I mentioned, the fusion has a smaller impact when entrainment is included. Now, the magnitude of CAPE comes out to be like 200 joules per kilogram. Well, is that even, I mean, that's so small. Is that even meaningful? But, of course, if you use this formula for W max, you get a 20 meter per second updraft for CAPE equals 200. And, you know, you can argue, well, this is the maximum W, not the real W. But remember, we've already put in entrainment and water loading. So I think the only thing we're leaving out now is the perturbation pressure gradient force in the rising parcel. So that basically even this small value of tape is enough to measure, you know, to give you values from what you see in tropical cyclones. Now, why does tape vary so little with radius in training tape? This is a plot from the same SONS of mean relative humidity with radius. And it turns out this looks very similar to a paper Bill Frank did many years ago on using Rayleigh SONS in the West Pacific. If you go out to the radius at which the cape was maximum in the pseudo-adiabatic, there's below 40% relative humidity above 7 kilometers. So it's really dry. I mean, this is presumably like a compensating subsidence around the hurricane. But it's very dry out here. When you entrain this dry air in, you dramatically reduce the buoyancy. And so that's basically physically what's responsible for this change in the radial profile. Okay. This is the radial profile of thin, and we have with and without entrainment. And notice the differences are much smaller. And thin is roughly constant with radius, except when you get in close, it's down to like 12 joules per kilogram, but it's about 15 after that. And entrainment has much less effect here, and I think the reason is we're talking about a much narrower layer, and also the bottom of the layer is well mixed. So that if you entrain in a dry adiabatic layer, it doesn't change the quality of the parcel. And of course, then, how much does it take to overcome this thin? Even though it's small, using the same formula we had earlier, you need a 5.5 meter per second updraft to overcome 15 joules per kilogram of thin. But of course, then there's the issue of the turbulent kinetic energy in tropical cyclones, and that's some of the recent studies from here that in the eye wall, which we don't have in this data set, of course, you can get order of 15 joules per kilogram or meter squared per second squared, same units of turbulent kinetic energy. But even out in these regions where you have a rain band, you can get 8 joules per kilogram. And so certainly it's easier to overcome this thin in the regions where you have the high turbulent kinetic energy. Now I want to get to the wind shear aspects. This is the famous schematic from Mike Black's paper in 02. Now, this is really just looking at the eyewall region, but of course, there's a very distinct signature. This is westerly shear in this schematic, and the updrafts are initiating down shear, and there's a lot of reflectivity down shear left, and to the left of shear. When you go further out, the initiation point is often over here, down shear right, but still, basically, you have a significant asymmetry as a result of the wind shear. But this data is outside the core, so then we need to go to some shear influence outside the 100-kilometer radius. And I've gotten this from the paper by Kristen Corbacero and I. We simply put a dot in for every lightning, cloud-to-ground lightning flash rotated with respect to the wind shear vector, so down shear is pointing up. And what you see is this is the 100-kilometer radius, this edge. And what you see is there's a lot of flashes down shear and around to down shear right. If you compare left of shear to right of shear at these radii, there's a lot more to the right than to the left. And up shear, you can see up shear and up shear left is very, very few lightning flashes. There's a dramatic influence on lightning, and lightning and tape should be presumably intimately related. So we're interested to see then what do we see in terms of distribution of tape. This is now from Shui Chen's paper. This is the distribution of precipitation with respect to shear, and it's a little less dramatic. You do see what Corbacero saw was that it was down shear left in the core, and it kind of rotated around to down shear and down shear right outside the core. It tends to stay more down shear left in precipitation than it did in lightning, and perhaps that just reflects the fact that the cells are growing here, but the precipitation is not falling out until around the left side of the shear. Now, what we're showing is mean tape. Now, from now on, all I'm doing is the full cape with 10% entrainment, 10% per kilometer entrainment, and with fusion, and with water loading, of course. What we have is the radial distribution of cape. Down shear is blue, and up shear is red. And then this is the same for sin. Well, the big picture is that in the inner, oh, and I'm sorry, when I made this figure, I took out the, I took out one panel, and there's no label on the radius, but this is basically 100 to 200, 200 to 300, and 300 to 400. So from the 400-kilometer radius on in, there's more cape down shear than up shear, and there's lower sin. And So one of the things then, this kind of goes opposite to what I said earlier, that do you expect less cape because it's convecting a lot? Well, no. At least once you add entrainment, where it's convecting the most, which is down shear in the inner core, you get larger cape. And where there's a significant suppression of convection up shear, you get much lower cape. It turns out that we used a bootstrap method, and the only significant differences up shear and down shear are at these two radii, 200 to 300 and 300 to 400. So now going forward, we're just going to sum everything over those radii. This is now the azimuthal distribution of tape, and what we've done here is used overlapping quadrants so that, for instance, the down shear one actually goes, it's a quadrant centered on down shear. This is a quadrant centered on down shear left. And what we see is very distinctly that the maximum cape is down shear and then down shear right. And you can see the largest cape is on this set from right to down shear left, and the minimum cape is from left of shear to up shear right. When we put this plot together with the plot from Corbacero's paper, what we did in that paper is it was tough to figure out, you know, in some storms you have 1,000 lightning flashes and in others you have 50. And so how do you look at all of these storms together without the storms with all the lightning dominating? What we did is for each storm, for each 12-hour period and for each octant with respect to the shear, we just counted the number of lightning flashes, and then whichever octant had the most, we just added one to that octant. So what this is showing is then that the down shear region had 71 instances in this, the down shear quadrant had 71 instances. So that was the most common lightning maximum, and that's where we had the most cape. And the second most common, 69, was down shear right, which has the second most. Then if we go over here, there's 31 events, and here there's 32. So that is this column and this column. And then when you go up shear, now it's only 9 events to the right, only 2, only 3, and only 13. And you can see that there's almost a 1-to-1 correspondence between cape and lightning frequency. So that's what I would expect. That's what cape should be telling us, I think, right? It should be telling us where we expect the convection to occur. So I would argue then that both from the inner core, comparing the middle radii to the inner core and comparing the azimuthally with respect to the shear, that actually there's the most cape where there's the most frequent lightning. And that has to be the case. I mean, to get lightning, you have to have strong updrafts. To have strong updrafts, you have to have cape. So it makes sense to me, but it did require the inclusion of entrainment too. Basically, you have to reduce the cape where there's drier a lot. The next question then is, why does entrainment contribute to upshear downshear differences? And that turns out to be pretty dramatic in the sense that what this is a temperature difference, downshear minus upshear, and what we find, and relative humidity difference. What we find is that it's much cooler downshear over a pretty deep layer from about 1 to 8 kilometers. And naturally, if it's cooler downshear, other things being equal, there'd be more cape. The other thing is that downshear, although the temperatures at the surface are almost the same, the specific humidity is higher. So that this also gives you a little more cape downshear. And then the relative humidity is really, it's more on average, it's 25% higher downshear at the 10 kilometer or 9 kilometer level than it is upshear. And so when you have entrainment, naturally downshear, the entrainment will have a lot less impact than upshear. So all of those three are contributing to the greater cape downshear. The first two, the fact that it's cooler and moister, arises, we assume, although we haven't measured this, from the stronger upward motion downshear. There's certainly plenty of studies that suggest that there's a lot stronger upward motion downshear. The last aspect of this, the surface humidity, we think is because, although I didn't show this, there's a 16% larger mean wind at the surface, mean wind speed at the surface downshear than upshear. And so you'd expect to get a little higher surface humidity. Now, we did another thing that's kind of interesting. The great benefit of the G4 songs is that there's thousands of them. And so we made the argument, which some people have accepted and some not, but the argument is that if you look at tropical cyclones, even in the core, the fraction of area that has active convection, now you have to define what you mean by that, but even if you take the fraction of area with greater than 1 meter per second updraft, it's not that large. And so the question is then, if only 10% or less of the area is convecting, especially outside the core, which is what we're looking at here, then maybe if we're trying to understand the influence of CAPE on convection, we should only look at the 10% largest CAPE and the 10% smallest SIN to see what's producing these differences. So we're kind of looking at the 90th percentile. When we do that, this is the scatter plot of SIN and CAPE. Now, we're still doing just between 200 and 400 kilometer radii because that's where the differences were significant. And so SIN is on this axis and CAPE on this, and we have downshear and upshear separately. Before I get into the colors, one thing you can see right away is that broadly there's a negative correlation. And Roger Smith and Mike Montgomery had a paper recently from the PREDICT data where they saw the same thing. It's interesting that where SIN is very large, CAPE is often zero. And you really see that upshear. I mean, the very large SINs seem to be accompanied by literally zero CAPE. And like if you look downshear, where CAPE is very large, because remember, these calculations are with all of the suppressing effects of entrainment, water loading, and everything. Where CAPE is very large, SIN tends to be very small. There is an inverse relationship. If you do a linear correlation, it's about minus 0.4. So it certainly shows up. Now, the other thing is the red circles show the minimum SIN values, the top 10% minimum SIN. And what you see is that they're actually, and then the yellow is the maximum CAPE, the top 10%, and the blue is the points that happen to have both minimum SIN and maximum CAPE. The minimum SIN, of course, is often zero or very, very close, like 1 joule per kilogram. And what's interesting is that the minimum SIN, 10%, is zero, really, both upshear and downshear. So what we argued is that perhaps it's not the SIN that's driving this difference. Even though there is a difference in the mean, a lot of that comes in these cases where there's zero CAPE, that perhaps the SIN is not having as much influence on the upshear-downshear differences as the CAPE is, because you can see that there's this large tail of the CAPE downshear where there's all these large values over 500 joules per kilogram, and there's none of those upshear. And the mean value of the top 10% of CAPE is more than double downshear what it is upshear. So I think I've said all of these things. But the argument is then perhaps that CAPE differences are what's driving this upshear-downshear difference.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I have a question at that point. Because if you get a really sheared tropical cyclone, 55 knots, 25 knots of shear, you often have zero convection on the upshear side. And I'm sure that while the CAPE is maybe lower, it can't be, it's probably not zero in those areas. Why is there such a dramatic difference where on one side you've got huge supercell-driven bursts, on the other side you've got absolutely nothing? And if you stratify your sons and check out cases like that.
No. I mean, the number of weak storms, unfortunately, is probably not large enough to. But I would actually, I think I would disagree, because the arguments you're using, there must be some CAPE up here, would be true for pseudo-adiabatic CAPE. But for once, upshear is very dry. And once you add entrainment, you drastically reduce that CAPE. And so I think that's actually a factor. And I mean, that's why I think CAPE is playing a significant role, even in cases like that.
So I would also argue that they have a force in there. You're wondering why it's not convective 500 kilometers away. Well, CAPE doesn't do any good if it's not relieved, and you have to start poking F drafts up through it, making them poke the F drafts there.
That's a good point. And I'll touch on that a little bit later. But yes, I agree. Now, what we're going to do now, this is going to be a very confusing figure. We're going to say, well, I mean, we've done all of these ranges of entrainment, and you can do with and without fusion, with and without entrainment. You can have four different values of entrainment. You can do with and without condensate loading, and you get this very confusing set of figures. But we try to say for these top 10% of profiles, this is a little confusing to explain, but here's the first part of it. It turns out that, I made a mistake here. Wow, this is interesting. So this should not say downshear CAPE. The downshear lightning frequency is 6 times the upshear lightning frequency. That's a rather mistake there. And so we know there's about 6 times as many lightning flashes downshear. We asked then, when we're testing all these different combinations, we say that at the very least, they should have downshear tape twice that of upshear. And the reason for that is that there's this interesting paper that finds that lightning frequency is proportional to W to the sixth. And W to the sixth is about cape cubed. So if you had twice the cape, you would have eight times the lightning by this reasoning. So our argument was then, if we're trying to say which of these combinations best fits the observed lightning frequency, twice the cape should do that. And then the other thing we argue is that downshear parcels should reach the top third of the troposphere, and admittedly a little arbitrary, but we're just saying 11 kilometers above, well, upshear do not. So if we put those two criteria in, and then we try all of these combinations of these things, we get this complicated profile. And one of the things that's interesting about this, this top one is all zero entrainment. And so there's with complete fallout, so this is like pseudo-adiabatic here. This is pseudo-adiabatic with fusion. It's reversible without fusion, reversible with fusion, and then for all 0% entrainment. What you find here is that if the entrainment's zero, then the upshear cape is almost as large as the downshear cape. And this is perhaps not surprising based on everything I've said up to now, but it does suggest that you do need to have entrainment in. Notice the huge differences in these vertical profiles of buoyancy when you start adding other things. I mean, it's really a dramatic impact. If we take 20% entrainment, the downshear sons, these 10% that we argue are controlling maybe the convective frequency, the cloud top is only like six or seven kilometers. So we argue that 20% entrainment is too large to produce the observed distribution. And it turns out that for those two criteria I listed, there's only two that actually meet that, and both of them have entrainment. If there's no fusion, then less entrainment fits the profile. But since we know there isn't fusion in nature, maybe this is the one that makes the most sense. The upshear cape is less than half the downshear, 10% per kilometer entrainment, and with the condensate retained and with fusion. But at the very least, these do give you a picture of how dramatically the vertical profile of buoyancy is affected. And you can imagine that for each vertical profile of buoyancy, you have a vertical profile of convergence, right? If you have a parcel accelerating upward, you have convergence underneath it. And you're going to get a very different vorticity structure for each of these sets of buoyancy. Now, of course, in numerical models, all of these effects are in there, so that they're incorporating this. All right, so summary. In tropical cyclones, the reversible and pseudo-adiabatic tape reach maximum at the outer radii, where convection is rare. But when entrainment is added, then we see, because of the dry air at outer radii, we see a much flatter distribution. Thin is relatively constant, except that it is smaller right in the storm core. I suspect if we got 0 to 100 kilometer radii, it might even be less than 12 joules per kilogram. Downshear and training cape is much larger than upshear, and this arises from the cooler and moister troposphere and the higher surface relative humidity. The largest cape in the downshear quadrant occurs in the storm core. I think this is an interesting point. In that profile we had, the most cape in the entire storm is in the core downshear, and then it's smaller at all other radii. And we think this has been more consistent with the observed convective structure. And certainly, as a mutually, we see this very close relationship between cape and lightning frequency. Thin variations seem to be less important. Now, this gets a little bit to what you were asking before, Jack, that we know convection consumes cape, so if there's the most cape where there's the most convection, something has to be creating cape in order to have that allowed. You have to have forcing. And what we think is happening is that downshear, where there's all of this cape, I mean all of this lightning and convection, that upward motion is larger, and that produces the observed pre-troposphere temperature and moisture anomalies. Surface fluxes are larger because of the winds, and this forcing basically maintains the cape against the loss to convection. And I think just the last slide, that so the main conclusion is that we think entrainment is needed in cape calculation, and that this large number of sons allowed us to look at this 10% of cape and sin distributions. And for that, the cape is double downshear, but the sin is similar, so that perhaps these cape distributions are what's driving the upshear downshear difference. That's all I have. Thank you.
Let's go to the phone first, John, for questions. Do if anybody on the phone has a question.
Is there anything I have to do here?
Just ask them if they have a question.
Okay, so for the anyone coming in by phone, have any questions?
Okay, and let's go to the audience.
So, Mike?
Yeah, John, first with mid-latitude, severe weather, Cape, and standard uses, prognostic tools, to study the onset of convection or predict it. I don't think that's the case in tropical cyclones, but the data that you have is kind of the chicken and egg argument. I would say that you can use this diagnostically, but the convection environment of the tropical cyclone is what you're measuring here. And so it's the distribution of convection that you're showing these differences. I'm just wondering what your thoughts of that is, using this as prognostic or diagnostic only.
Right. So in other words, you're saying if you had a sond in real time and you had the Cape value from that sond, could you use that? Is that the question?
Well, yeah, I'm just wondering if, any of the differences that you're seeing, I think they're the result of what's happening within the tropical cyclone itself.
Yes.
And really can't use that as any kind of prognostic.
Well, that's an interesting question, because one thing we've been doing is we've been just there's this amazing literature for mid-latitude convection. I mean, it's astounding. It's this fantastic empirical work, operational research connecting these various parameters to the convective intensity. And we have just tried dragging those ideas right into tropical cyclones. And one thing that we found recently, we're simulating a tropical storm Gabrielle, the one that we wrote, the papers on. And we just calculated this thing called the energy helicity index that they use all the time in middle latitude. So it's a normalized Cape times a normalized helicity. And it is astounding what happens in that simulation. Gabrielle is just sitting there kind of disorganized. And the EHI just dramatically rises in the core. And unfortunately, we just got this result, so I can't even tell you why that happens yet. But the EHI dramatically rises. Right down share of that, there's this big convective outbreak. The eye wall wraps all the way around, and the storm just blows up. And so the question is, we have this great literature of mid-latitudes. How much of it can we try to just brute force apply to tropical cyclones? There's a lot of reasons why you could be skeptical. But in that case, it's looking pretty promising. So we'll see. I don't know. Yeah, John.
I have a follow-up. Actually, it is used prognostically in both CIF and LGEM.
Oh, in the LGEM, absolutely.
And
yes.
And there is a predictor in CIF.
Yes. Yes.
They are used prognostically, and they are important predictors.
And the great thing about LGEM, I mean, I love that 2009 paper, Mark DiMaria, because he's looking at environmental tape, and he's including all of these things. He's using Rick Oyama's code for doing that. And it's an important predictor. And what's interesting is that's the tape of the environment. It's 200 to 800, I think the average is right in LGEM.
Right, but it's not as sophisticated, but it's often.
Okay, yeah.
But it doesn't have the,
the beauty of LGEM, it has the entrainment, yeah.
But it is a statistically significant predictor for the use, so it is used by the whole model. So
okay.
There is a signal that is real.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, Jeff.
But I think it brings up one of the limitations of this, and I have a little problem with your idea of trying to correlate the Cape and the lightning, because to me, the Cape is not the only vector. If you get a storm that's stronger than sheared, the convection is going to be less tropical cyclone type and more mid-latitude type, to the point where the updrafts themselves may actually be rotating like supercells. And at that point, it's not the Cape, it's the perturbation pressures that also are playing a major role in your updraft strength and your lightning flash density. And
right.
Some of the most intense lightning producers and coldest cloud tops are not the big, strong hurricanes, but are the partly baked, strongly sheared tropical storms. Tropical storm Gold would have the coldest cloud tops I've ever seen in the Atlantic hurricane, some of the biggest lightning flash density, but it was supercell-type convection and not tropical cyclone rain band or eyewall-type convection.
Right, although I would argue, especially if you can combine this with helicity. Now, helicity can be computed from a single sond as well. That Cape and helicity measure is probably better describing the kind of convection you're. So I guess the question is, and I'm not sure of the answer, but the question is whether we can use those K Cape Felicity type concepts. And there's a million other parameters in the middle latitudes, too. We haven't even tested them all. But we might be able to use those. They might be applicable to tropical cyclones that would cover all those types. They might cover the rain band convection that's weaker and, you know, and those that strongly shared storms or the strong local share that get more supercell-like. Yep.
How do you think, if you haven't looked at it, how do you think the results would change if you stratify by low, medium, and strong shear?
Well, actually, we did do that. It's interesting. You know, Chris, with our lightning data, of course, we did that, strong, medium. And actually, even in the lightning data, you get a strong downshear signal, even for 0 to 5 knot, or 0 to 5 meter per second shear. But in this case, we started out separating by, I think, we found a value in which half the storms had less shear and half had more. It might have been like 8 meters per second or something, or shear, something like that. And the results were very similar. And so in order to get statistical significance of these differences, we just threw everything back together again. So it surprised me a little that for some reason it didn't seem that sensitive to the shear magnitude.
Well, related to that, I think if you bend it by where it's going, I guess everyone's related to that question. But, if you look at, I have a speaking suspicion, if you look at shear direction, that is a northerly component versus southerly component, it seems very significant difference with regards to upshear and downshear thermodynamic structures, and which essentially is you think about what you're saying, the argument is on the upshear side you're drier. Well, I can guarantee you're a whole lot drier on the upshear side if you're coming from a northerly shear direction than you're coming from essentially from clearly.
Right.
We're seeing the papers that we're putting together now show a big connection between the shear direction and what the low of a thermodynamic structure looks like. And it's a definite connection between what, if you're talking, coming from polar or coming from clearly. So I think if you stratify and specify direction, I mean by magnitude, if you looked at direction, some sort of caveat for let's say northerly versus southerly shear, I'd be interested in seeing that.
Yeah, that's interesting, because, of course, that would be smeared out in this, where we're just throwing everything together. I assume that effect would be larger the further poleward you went, and maybe smaller in the deeper tropics.
Yeah, well, our database tends to be somewhat near landfall. We have Gulf systems. We have, somewhat offshore, but you're having some. The interesting thing is, we haven't done yet, Jim and I want to look at this. Some of the reviewers think, well, a lot of the results are because you're near the United States and you're near landfall. Not so sure. If you look at go out farther east, okay, you don't have the land, but now you have the sal air.
Right.
In that same relative position north of where the storm's coming off. And I'm showing that, but I bet you did see that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Uh-huh. And it's moisture, it's not temperature. Really,
yes.
It's a moisture thing, it's not a temperature.
Uh-huh.
You saw that it's very important to see good improvement in the Cape population. You also saw that the Cape population is very sensitive to the parameterization of Cape. So, like, you put 10%, 20% of improvement. But if you do it in for the operational purpose or from a research point of view, the way to actually the yield.
Well, what we concluded is the 10% seems to work best. In other words, if you include the full physics with the fusion and the condensate loading, the 10% per kilometer seems to best produce the observed convective distribution.
To my knowledge, the parameterization of the Finland is based on observation outside
origin. Oh, right. Right. Oh, absolutely. It's certainly possible. I mean, in a sense, what we're doing here, the entrainment part, I mean, and of course, you have to put in, I mean, in these numerical models, it's in there, but that's absolutely the part that can be criticized the most, because we don't really know how it occurs in nature, and it's a great simplification. But my argument basically is that the effect is so large that however you put it in, you really see an impact. And so even though it's, you know, we don't even understand the process well, it seems that some representation of entrainment needs to be in there.
So. Broader question. All these islands are from the Atlantic. There might be some East Pacific in there. Do you think you'd get a different would you recommend that a similar study be done with West Pacific sounds to try to see if there's any difference?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's possible there could be a difference because, you know, in the Atlantic, the SST is often just marginally good enough, and in the West Pacific, it's all plenty warm, and it's possible that the distributions would look quite different. And now that I think about it, even upshear, if you upshear, you put a much warmer ocean underneath it, then maybe, I don't know, it's possible that in the West Pacific, it could look different, definitely.
About 500 sounds out there.
Yeah, I'll tell you about the numbers. I mean, even with 2,400 here, it was really hard to get the significance on the difference fields. I mean, it had to be substantial signal in order to meet the test.
You know, one comment I would make, John, is that while we're trying to diagnose these models, this would be another way to evaluate the model structures, the simulations of what H4 is or whatever. You know, we have hundreds of thousands of these now.
Yes.
We could do a lot of diagnostics and looking at it and compare them. I think it's just another way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest maybe while we could take a look at something like that, diving into the things. Because I think this is a valuable tool to help us, because the convective parameterization is driving most of the stuff out there, and that's where the assumption of the training is going.
Right.
And the explicit inner core stuff is probably a little different. And I know Gopal's online, but I suggest Gopal and Jim think about it. Any more comments or questions?
I'm hearing you, Frank. That's a good comment.
Go ahead, Gopal.
Okay. I'm hearing to that. Thanks.
You heard me. Okay.
Yeah.
Peter.
Are they doing this in the mid-latitudes operationally?
Oh, no, they're not. And so, see, that's another option is that I when I first started thinking about this, I said, wow, we could, like, reform mid-latitude thinking. You know, we could have our new EHI and all these million parameters and put in training tape in there. But the middle latitudes, it turns out, are a little funny. I mean, the reason all of these things have developed as they have is because they work. And the weird thing about middle latitudes is that the Cape would almost always be small. In Oklahoma, it's always dry at mid-levels. And what happens is those very, very few parcels that somehow overcome that then can produce these supercells. And I really wonder if we just kind of naively went in and tried to redefine all the mid-latitude parameters using in training Cape that everything would fail. Because they use the thing, and in fact, they use something that, I forget who it was, called it an abomination. They told me, I think it might have been Gary Barnes, the maximum updraft cape. He said they pull a sound out of some shed, and they release it, and then they find the maximum cape in that sounding, and it hasn't even, you know, adjusted to its environment. He thinks that's like a horrible variable. And yet, it works in mid-latitudes. And so I'm not sure. I think these concepts actually might work better in the tropics than in the latitudes.
But having lots of those mid latitudes supercells in person, I would argue that sometimes those updrafts are so large in terms of size, they can be 6 to 10 miles across, that the percentage of parcels that actually go up undiluted once you're past the boundary layer may be higher than the smaller size tropical convection. I mean,
that's right.
We've got updrafts out there that are larger than the eye wall of Hurricane Wilma, for example. I would argue that circumstances might be a different percentage of entrainment.
Yes.
I don't argue that entrainment is a big issue because you get the cool downdrafts that come around both sides of the supercell, but those updrafts are so big compared to both of their tropical counterparts.
Right, so that's another argument where maybe if you just try to blindly put in training cape in mid-latitudes, it might not work.
Okay, John is here until what time today?
Well, probably most of the day if there's people
and
interested.
He's in the visitor office. I know he has a schedule. We're all put together. There's a couple of us that are tough to call. Come talk with me right afterwards. So he's going to be around, and please, if you want to have some time with John, let him know, and we'll make sure that you get into the schedule. We do want to ask our co-sponsor, the AMS chapter, Falco's here. Falco,
also wanted to have a little bit of business related to the EMS chapter. So I'm going to turn off the recording and turn this over to Thapo and thank John. Thank you, John.
Okay, Thapo, you're on.